Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Hidden Histories. Today I interview Joanna Katrine Friedrich's daughter. She has written Valkyrie, The Women of the Viking World, which is a fantastic new book about what a woman's role was in the Viking era, how women were expected to act, or what they were expected to do. She draws on the latest historical and archaeological evidence, but she also looks into the Norse sagas and myths that tell the stories of war, strife, loyalty, murder and betrayal. All in all, her book is a fantastic story. I hope that you enjoy the podcast. So Joanna, welcome to Hidden Histories.
Thank you so much for having me, Helen.
Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. And I am so excited for this podcast because I am obsessed with Vikings and particularly Viking women, because up until fairly recently, I don't think there's been a huge amount of research done on women of the Viking world. And your new book, Valkyrie, Women of the Viking World, does just that. So I just wanted to check with you. The term Viking is not a noun, is it? It's more of a verb. It's to be Viking, to go Viking. Is that correct?
Yeah, in English usage, modern English, it's kind of become a verb. It's sort of used quite differently, but in Old Norse sources, it's used as a noun, and it's used as like a label about someone who is a Viking, and you can't really use it as a verb in Old Norse, but it kind of has more of a loose meaning probably than what it's used like now in modern English. So it didn't mean necessarily that you were the kind of stereotypical grisly man who went off to sort of raid and pillage. It could kind of mean that you were someone who traveled and you went abroad, and that would have sometimes involved like land taking or like hunting whales and then bringing back, you know, the stuff that they harvested off that, or trade. So there were kind of all kinds of things that you could be as a Viking, but it very often probably involved raids as well.
Okay. And what did that, with that terminology, what did that mean for women? Could women be described as Viking?
We don't really know whether women would have used that about themselves, because we have very few written sources from the Viking Age itself. And there are some runestones, which are these stones that people put up like in nature when they were usually placed kind of at crossroads, so you would have seen them when you were walking from one kind of important place to another. And they would put these inscriptions on the runestones. And that's like more or less the only written sources that we have from the Vikings themselves, or from the Scandinavians who lived in this period, the Norse people. So we just know that women were doing quite a lot of the same things as the men, and we find archaeological evidence from all kinds of places where the men were. And some of this evidence is quite gendered. So if we find the kind of brooch that like women wore, and men didn't wear those sorts of brooches, and we found spindle whorls, so women's work was textile work most of the time. So we know that the women were off taking land and doing trade in far off places with the men.
So the women were moving in the same way as men were, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, there might not have been as many of them, but they were there.
What part of Scandinavia did Vikings come from specifically, or was it all over Scandinavia?
Yeah, it seems to have been, an all-over development in Sweden, Norway and Denmark, and then people would go off in different directions depending on, so like in Sweden they tended to kind of go like down the rivers in Russia and Ukraine and Poland, and because that was just kind of most natural for them to go east, whereas like in Denmark they would go like west and end up in England and Scotland maybe, and then the Norwegians, just being further north, they would often like go maybe to Scotland, and then the Faroes and Iceland, and so it, you know, obviously people mixed, but those were kind of the general patterns probably.
So within Viking society, what sort of roles did women take on? You mentioned spinning before and needlework.
The women were probably running the household sort of quite generally, and especially when the men were away, they were doing a lot of hard work. But in general, the kind of work that they were doing most of the time was probably textile work, because just the amount of work that you needed to do just to make one shirt or an outfit, that was just weeks and weeks. So it was just so time consuming to keep your family like clothed and fed. And then in the Viking Age as well, there was all this demand for sales. So if you were quite resourceful and hardworking, you could probably have like a sort of side business, maybe doing textile work for sales as well. And I don't know how much time we have. I can go deeper into just what, like, why it was so much work to get from wool to a ready-made textile.
Well, I do actually. I mean, funnily enough, I've actually held some Viking textile work before, because I did something at the Viking Museum. Have you been to the Jorvik Museum?
Yeah, in
York?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing museum. Actually, many years ago, I used to work there when I was a student.
Oh, really?
But more recently, I went there and somebody was kind enough to show me an example of some of the textile work that they found in one of the excavations. And it's so intricate, it's absolutely amazing, and so strong. I mean, it's the sort of thing that you just, you know, you'd pay a huge amount of money for today, just because it's so so much work and time has clearly gone into it.
It's just really astonishing. Like, I will be the first to admit, I hadn't really thought about just the amount of effort. I mean, I knit myself, so I do kind of know how long it takes to knit a garment. And I mean, I obviously don't sit there full time and do it, but it would take me several months to make like a cardigan or something. But that means that I already, like, I buy the wool, but to have like a sheep, and I would have to, you know, get the wool off the sheep and pick out all the bits of straw and everything and comb it and spin it. And then when you're weaving, I mean, you have to set up the loom and just think about like all of the threads that you would have to like set up before you even started weaving, and then like just the weaving itself taking forever.
So it's certainly not fast fashion, is it?
No, I know, and it's just something that I've become more interested in, I suppose, just with the kind of reaction that we have maybe now to fast fashion, and people kind of wanting to be more sustainable and thinking more about like where our clothes come from. And so it's just all put, you know, things more into perspective, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and like also like with knitting now, for example, it's kind of this almost like a hygge, you know, the Scandinavian term for like having it nice and it's like a lifestyle. But like for these women, it was not like cups of tea and candles and knitting. It was just hard work. And their, you know, their hands would have been just arthritic when they were like not very old. And like just, it was just so much work.
And you've very closely studied the sagas for your book. And the sagas, I mean, for those of you, for those who are listening who aren't familiar with what a saga is, can you explain what these Norse sagas were?
Yeah, so the sagas were written down by Icelanders mostly in the 13th century and 14th century. And they are kind of long prose accounts, a little bit like novels. They are really kind of well written. They sort of conform to our tastes. They have a lot of, like, they're stylistically, they're just really fascinating. And they're being written down several hundred years after the Viking Age. So we can't really take them completely at face value. Like, they're not eyewitness accounts. But because they tend to kind of represent society in a very similar way, we can sort of trust them to a large extent on the general social structures and gender roles and like what people were sort of thinking about and how they like their values, how they saw each other and what they prioritized. And then, you know, in terms of like how historically accurate they are, like sometimes, you know, people have found archaeological evidence that kind of, you know, matches with what a saga will say. So they are really, really interesting. But then, you know, the people who wrote them were also authors. And so they made up conversations and, you know, they made people, like their characters, larger than life. And so, yeah, like we have to kind of analyze them with a grain of salt.
But still they provide some entertaining detail on Viking life. Were there many, do women feature very much in the sagas, or is it mostly a masculine genre?
It really varies by sort of author and subgenre. So, for example, the king's sagas, which are more interested in the kind of politics in Norway and like kings and queens and factions having rivalries in Norway, like that is a very masculine world, and we see women in kind of quite limited roles. And like often it's just like, you know, a woman is brought up just to mention like who she was married to or something. But then when you get into the so-called sagas of Icelanders, those sagas are about the people who settled in Iceland, often from Norway, and their descendants. And they kind of often follow these kind of sprawling feuds and like several generations.
Yeah.
And there, I think that the authors kind of, they have a little bit more freedom to put their own mark on the characters. And so some saga authors, like the author of the saga of the Laxardal people, or Laxdæla saga, like it's called in Old Norse, that author in particular seems to be really interested in women and like why women's roles are more limited and sort of problematizing it. And so there's like one character who in the beginning who's a woman, and she goes to Iceland and settles by herself and like takes land, and she's this kind of matriarch, and she always like reminds me a little bit of like Olenna Tyrell, if you're a Game of Thrones fan. She's just,
I am definitely a Game of Thrones fan.
Yeah, like you just do not mess with this woman.
Yeah.
And then there's this there's another woman who kind of her husband treats her really badly and divorces her in a kind of scumbag way, and she kind of goes off in the middle of the night and attacks him in bed and like wounds him. Like she doesn't kill him or anything, but it kind of feels like there's a lot of poetic justice, because when the man is kind of asked like, aren't you gonna go and like avenge yourself, and he's like, no, I deserved it. And you wouldn't really get that kind of thing in some of the other sagas, which are just not really interested in women. And so it just depends.
So do you think that women were in some way, even though their roles were more limited, they were treated fairly equally or even revered, rather than considered to be a weaker sex?
I think, like, you know, everything else in life, it depended a little bit, you know, just from family to family. I think in some pockets of society, like, the men were probably not very keen on having women anywhere near the decision making or anything. But it seems that there were certainly a lot of men in Norse society who were willing to make space for women, and maybe because, you know, if they were away for long periods of time, then, like, coming back and then, like, telling a woman who's been running, you know, the show for months on end or years, telling her that, like, suddenly she just doesn't get any say in anything and she's supposed to be subservient, like, that might not have worked out so well.
In the sagas, there's also a lot of conflict, isn't there? And we do know that conflict was part of Viking life and the way of life. What did that mean for a woman? And I have to ask you, did the shield maiden exist?
Yeah, well, if we kind of start with the first half of the question, the conflicts, I guess you could separate them into going off and, you know, being a Viking, going to England or Ireland or somewhere and, you know, stealing stuff from monasteries. And I mean, I doubt that there were that many women who were involved in maybe that side of things, but there were probably some. And then you have the kind of more sort of feud-like conflicts maybe at home in Scandinavia. And they sort of seem to spring from a system where, like, sort of life in general, but especially masculinity, is extremely precarious. And so if anyone, like, insults you, you have to kind of answer back, you know, twofold. And if you don't, like, sort of display how strong you are all the time, then you just make yourself very vulnerable. And so it seems that, or the way that the sagas represent this system is basically that, like, women's role in that is to kind of goad the men. And if they aren't, like, being strong enough, they sort of go into this role of, like, shaming them and, you know, telling them they're not manly enough. And that always used to confuse my students, because they would be like, why are they pushing their own men into, like, going into some sort of violent conflict when, you know, their husband or their son might die if they, you know, if they go off and attack someone because they insulted them. And I think that kind of goes back to, like, women's position, like, not being as strong as men's. And so they're kind of reliant on the men holding up the family as a whole. And so the shield maiden is this amazing literary figure. And so this woman that I mentioned before, who goes and attacks her husband because he divorces her, she kind of isn't that great with weapons, so she's not really able to wield them very well. The kind of the saga makes the point of making that clear. But then there is this other subgroup of sagas where there are, like, real shield maidens who, like, there's one called Hervor in the saga of Hervor, and she tells her mother, she's, like, an only child, and so she tells the mother that she wants to be a Viking, and please outfit me like you would a son. And so the mother gives her, you know, the whole Viking kit, like the sword and everything, and, like, a ship. And then she goes off and, like, goes off raiding, and she's a Viking for a while, and then, like, she comes back one day and decides she doesn't want to do that anymore. And the saga then says, and then she, like, took up her embroidery again. And so there's this kind of really interesting blurring of gender boundaries there. And then while she is a Viking, she actually, like, has a male name, and all of the pronouns in the saga switch to male. So, like, it's like she's just suddenly this other character. And there doesn't seem to be, like, a concept, at least in that particular saga, of, like a woman, like still being able to retain her femininity and be a Viking, if you see what I mean. So if you are a Viking, you are male, whether or not your body is male.
Yeah, so you can move between those two different gendered spheres, but you had to take on the gender that you were essentially occupying.
Yeah, exactly. At least to this particular saga author. And then, I mean, it's really hard to kind of try to interpret these graves where, like, there are these skeletons that have been sexed female and they're in these graves. It's like, you know, with lots of weapons in them. And I will...
That was quite a recent archaeological discovery, was it?
Yeah. I mean, the big famous grave that has been kind of sparking the debate is... Actually, it was excavated in the late 19th century. So what's new is that they did a DNA test of the bones, and the bones were female. And I think there's like a similar test being done on another grave. And I sort of hasten to add that these are like two graves out of thousands of graves that have been excavated from the Viking Age. And they sort of, to me, they seem to get like disproportionate attention. Yeah, so that's sort of what's new in that sphere, the archaeological sphere.
But the term shield maiden is a modern term.
Yeah.
It's not something that appeared in the sagas. And it's
it does appear in the sagas, yeah.
It does?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, but the kind of, the question is whether... It's a translation of the word Amazon, and whether these authors have decided to translate it that way.
Okay, so the title of your book is Valkyrie. Who were the Valkyries, and why have you chosen that as your title? I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really... they're just absolutely these... striking figures from Norse mythology. They appear in lots and lots of Norse poetry, and they are supernatural, and they have different manifestations, I guess, like different people had different ideas about them. And they hover in the air when there's a battle often, and sometimes they seem to be like on horseback. And for example, there's one poet who describes this Valkyrie as like having lots of blood on her armor, because there's just all this blood like spattering on her. And then sometimes they're really greedy for blood, and they're kind of macabre and just scary and unpleasant, really. And then sometimes like they're more sort of romantic and beautiful and like sexually alluring and so on. But they seem to be sort of figures that people project different ideas about, like how they feel about war and about death. And they are like Odin's maidens. That's how they are often referred to in the poetry and the mythology. And so it seems that they get sent by Odin to battles, and they get to choose the slain. So they choose who gets to go to Odin and to Valhalla and basically feast and have fun for the rest of their sort of undead life, I guess. And these are like these figures who have been... You know, they've just been fascinating readers and audiences for hundreds of years. And I suppose, like in Wagner's operas, they're kind of the most famous. There's this Ride of the Valkyrie. I don't know if that rings a bell, but like that kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Definitely.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's amazing. Your description of them in the air, you can kind of see why that is so inspirational, because it's such a powerful image.
Yeah, and it's an image of strength and, you know, being assertive and having all this mobility and freedom and agency. You know, they get to choose who lives and dies. And so, I mean, I also say in the book, they kind of help rationalize, like, who dies. So it, you know, I guess in battle, it can be quite random who survives and who doesn't. And there are all these like spears flying out of the air. And sometimes the diction in the poetry calls them spear girls. And so my interpretation of this was basically that they're kind of a way of rationalizing, like if your brother or son dies in battle, that it was the decision of a Valkyrie, and you know, this maiden of Odin, and it's like a higher power. So maybe that helped some people.
What I find really interesting about that is that your description of these women, of these Valkyries wearing armor, but they are very feminine, which is the opposite to the woman in the saga that you described, who had to either take on a masculine identity, mm-hmm. or a traditionally feminine one. So it's interesting that is a deity, the Valkyrie, can hold both roles, hold both genders.
Yeah, and sort of hover in between them somewhere, and
yeah.
And have this sort of violent, scary aspect to them that isn't really allowed in the more realistic sphere. And it's like having them being supernatural, it kind of lets people imagine all sorts of things for, you know, that they can do that maybe for some people would have been some sort of escapism or like compensation for lack of maybe agency in the real world. But on the other hand, these kind of goading women that I was talking about before, like they have some overlap maybe with them, because they, in a way, like they are the ones who send, you know, their family members off to a certain death sometimes. And the kind of more legendary heroic sources are really preoccupied with like, why do women go into this role? And they sort of have almost like Valkyrie aspects of them.
It's interesting because it's almost like women birth the men who are the powerful, the protectors, yet women also take their lives as well.
Yeah, and there is just this kind of abject and aspect of them. And I sort of said in the book that there is this sort of maybe psychological urge to, you know, project all these more violent instincts that people have and, you know, cast them onto the woman who, like, she made me do it and it's her fault. I'm just a tool. And it sort of, by giving them agency, it, like, absolves the men maybe more, you know, from enacting all kinds of violent acts.
So what did the death of a man, say the husband or the father of women, what did that mean for women within that family sphere?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question, because like when you got married, that was essentially when you entered like the adult sphere, and you gained quite a lot of rights, and if you were married, like women usually got a dowry, and so they and they had more right to inherit and all kinds of things. So like getting married was usually like a good thing, but losing your husband wasn't necessarily bad. And they like the saga sort of depict women as like having all kinds of like different reactions, maybe on an emotional level. But then there was this kind of ritual that, or like you had to kind of go through certain emotions. You had to lament, and you had to get someone to avenge your husband, usually if he died in some sort of feud. But the sagas also have instances where there are these widows living kind of maybe not alone, but maybe like there's one that I'm really fond of who lives with her daughter and a man who's enslaved. He's a servant laborer. And then there's this man who kind of starts hanging around the daughter, and you can't really do that without, you know, marrying them. You can't cast any sort of aspersions on a woman's honor if she's supposed to.
Yeah, it's interesting. So women still retain that quite traditional and popular conception of honor and purity and chastity prior to marriage, an actual value for men. But prior to marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't, there's no sort of religious dimension to it. It's just a patriarchal thing. It's just that the men have to control the women, like in their protection. And if another man like gets close to your woman, that means that you haven't like done enough. And so this woman who's in this position where she doesn't have a man to protect the honor of the family, she resorts to magic and then bribery. And it kind of just shows that this saga author is kind of really preoccupied with like what happens if, you know, if you get these men who are like essentially being antisocial and troubling you and your family, and you don't have someone to enact the traditional male role. Like, what are your options and recourses? And you don't really have a lot of options.
And you mentioned that you have looked in some of the archaeology behind Viking excavations and Viking life. What are some of the most gripping and fascinating evidence that you've discovered that reveals what life was like for Viking women?
I think it was pretty well known, you know, of the sort of basic lifestyle of the Vikings, you know, the sort of living together as a family unit. The average family unit was like 7 to 11 people usually. So it would be like a man and a woman and a few kids and maybe like a grandparent and a couple of servants. And then I guess what fascinated me the most, sort of coming back to the textiles, was that there was, for example, there was this place in Norway in this fjord, which is like enormously long, called the Sognefjord. And they excavated, I think, sort of quite recently, like maybe 10 years ago or something. And they found this kind of almost like a summer camp where people used to just go for the summer when you can have your sheep on pasture. And so the sheep would be grazing in like the mountains, and then you could get the wool off them, and they would be kind of processing the wool and weaving. And they might have been making sails for the Viking ships. And then, so they would hang out there in the summer, and then they would just go back home to wherever they lived. And I think this is maybe one of the sort of less studied or acknowledged aspects of Viking life, but it's just so important because the ships would just not have got to England and Ireland and all these places without sails. And like everyone's really fascinated with the ships and the, you know, with the weapons and so on. But like making a sale was just, like, it would have taken one person 4 to 5 years just to make a sale if they worked like all day. And so we don't really realize just how expensive it was. And, you know, it would have been really highly valued by the Vikings.
And why that was so much a part of everyday life because of its value.
Yeah, exactly. And this was one of the things that I think surprised me and fascinated me the most, just how central this work is to the economy and to all these social changes that happen in the Viking Age. You wouldn't have got anywhere without these sails or without clothes. And so why hasn't this been acknowledged more?
So if somebody was going to visit, like on the back of your book, after reading your book, if somebody was to go and visit some places to get a feel for what life was like for Viking women, where would you recommend to go to? Just if someone wants to explore this a bit further.
I suppose depends on time and money, but I'm from Iceland, obviously, and I think traveling around Iceland is fabulous. And Iceland was settled by Vikings, so it is a really good place to go if you want to kind of, you know, imagine yourself as a Viking land taker and settler. But when I first went to Sweden, I thought it was so fabulous when you're just around somewhere like, I went to Uppsala, and right in front of the university, there are just these runestones standing there. Yeah, and they just have these runes on them, and they don't like say anything particularly interesting. Like most of the time, runestones are sort of a little bit like, so-and-so raised this runestone in memory of his father, or, you know, and just very prosaic inscriptions most of the time. But I just thought it was so amazing to have this direct connection in the physical landscape to someone who lived in the Viking Age. And maybe because they are so prosaic, it makes you kind of, it reminds you that these people were, you know, ordinary people with their hopes and dreams and family problems. And, you know, they weren't all kind of like, you know, the stereotypes. And
Exactly. Physical manifestation of the Viking person that's endured for 1,000 years is amazing. Well, thank you so much, Joanna. That was absolutely fascinating. And I feel like I've learned so much from that. I really have. And I will certainly be reading your book. And when is it out? When is it available for people to buy?
It just came out, actually, last Thursday. So
great. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's been really fascinating to see, like, on Twitter, people posting pictures of it having arrived in the mail, and feels very surreal when you've, you know, worked on something so hard and it's just finally out. So
congratulations.
Excited. Yeah, thank you.
Great. So it's so available for people by now. So go forth and purchase and learn all about all of these fascinating female Viking characters.